please visit RaphaelFilm.cafilm.org or call 415-454-1222. That number again, 415-454-1222. Thank you.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for About Health.
Good afternoon and welcome to About Health. I'm Nurse Rona, your host twice a month, here to explore different concepts of physical and emotional health and well-being. So, do you ever experience sudden fear when you're in a car, in an airplane, or on a bridge? Do you feel kind of panicky when you're separated from your kids or spouse? Or maybe you spend a lot of time thinking and planning what you're going to say in social situations. Or perhaps you're really frightened by heights, MRI machines, or spiders. 40 million adults in the United States, ages 18 and older, are affected by anxiety disorders, and high anxiety affects 1 in 8 children as well. It's normal and sometimes helpful to worry or feel anxious about some things in life. You know, for example, worrying about eating foods that have been treated with pesticides might motivate you to buy more organic food. Or being worried about a funny sound your car is making can push you to take it in for an overdue tune-up. But for some people, anxiety comes with limiting activities and limiting relationships, and anxiety can affect a person's health. So today we'll talk about various aspects of anxiety disorders and what kind of help can reduce your suffering so you can enjoy life more. Joining me in studio is Jennifer Shannon. She's the co-founder of the Santa Rosa Center for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. She's a marriage and family therapist with over 30 years of clinical experience. As a cognitive behavioral therapist, she specializes in things like anxiety disorders, which includes social anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, separation anxiety, panic disorder, phobias, and generalized anxiety. She works with children, teens, and adults, and is the author of The Anxiety Survival Guide for Teens and The Shyness and Social Anxiety Workbook. Jennifer Shannon, welcome to About Health.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, great. I want to start off just with you telling us a little bit about what motivated you to write these two books that you've written on anxiety for teens.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I really never did see myself as an author. I love seeing clients, and that's my passion. But what happened, I have 3 children, and when my daughter Rose was in middle school, she developed really quite crippling social anxiety. At first, it was, you know, I was able to still get her to school, but there was a point to which she actually refused to get out of bed. And a 13-year-old who's refusing to get out of bed, you can't physically lift them up and carry them to school. So in working, of course, getting her to see a therapist, but I wanted to have her be able to read material about social anxiety, help her understand how common it was. And, of course, I was already a therapist treating this, but when you have your own daughter who's going through it, they don't want you to be their therapist,
right,
which is a healthy instinct of theirs.
Yes.
And so I started looking for books on social anxiety for teens, and although there's hundreds of titles out there for adults, there were actually no books for adolescents. And since adolescence is the age of onset for social anxiety disorder, which is the most common type of anxiety, I felt very motivated to write a book for teens to help them understand that they're not alone and that there's help for them.
That's a great story, and it sounds like from what you said, your daughter's doing really well and got the help when she needed it.
That's right.
You know, and that, I think, is so often the key and why I have these shows, is trying to encourage people. You know, it's never too late
That's right.
To be able to get help for whatever you're dealing with. But the earlier we can, you know, intervene, the better.
Absolutely.
And your book, The Anxiety Survival Guide for Teens, I found really good. I found it explained things that I wanted to understand in a really friendly way with great cartoons that I guess your husband does.
He does.
And I love the concept of monkey mind. And I mm-hmm. thought that would be a great place to start to help people understand what we're talking about in terms of anxiety. And again, like always, this show is a show where we welcome your calls, your questions, and also your experience. Some of you might have some really good ideas about what helped you. The number here is 510-848-4425 or toll free 1-800-958-9008. So let's start with monkey mind.
Okay, great. Well, first of all anxiety originates with the perception of threat. We're hardwired for safety and for survival. And this perception happens in the tiny part of our brain called the amygdala, which is often referred to as the fear center of our brain. And the amygdala is dedicated to our survival, keeping us alive and part of the tribe. Because this part of the brain is so highly reactive, instinctive, and primitive, I refer to it as the monkey mind. And yeah, so the monkey mind.
And it's something that I've heard other people use, mm-hmm. right? It's a term that seems to people can relate to.
Yeah, I think it really describes that kind of hyperactive, hypervigilant, kind of always looking for threat and highly reactive. So
I can relate.
Yeah. I think most of us can. I mean, even, you know, you talked about anxiety disorders, which affect 40 million Americans. But the truth is most of us have some level of anxiety, and oftentimes it may not be interfering with our functioning. It is interfering with quality of life.
So say something more about that monkey mind and how mm-hmm. it relates to anxiety.
So I have tried to simplify things. And so I believe that basically the monkey mind, which is that survival looking for threats, comes down to two primordial threats. And the first one is death. Death of self, death of loved ones, and this could, or extreme loss of health, whether physical or mental, loss of shelter, loss of food. So that's a number one primordial threat that the monkey mind is going to be very alerted to. And the second one is getting kicked out of the tribe.
Mm.
Because, you know, we are pack animals, and we need to belong in order to feel fulfilled.
Right. So I could see with social anxiety,
absolutely.
For instance, if I think going to that party is going to embarrass me, I'm going to say something wrong, better I stay home than get kicked out of the tribe.
Right. And that's where, so the monkey mind makes two mistakes.
Uh-huh.
And these are the two mistakes it will always make. It will overestimate the threat. So the belief that you'll go to the party and say something stupid, that you'll get kicked out of the tribe, because what kicked out of the tribe means that no one will speak to you. No one will talk to you. You have no friends. You may say something stupid at a party, because the truth is probably, Rana, we've all said something stupid at a party. But that doesn't mean we're all getting kicked out of the tribe. And if we can tolerate that discomfort and go, hey, I was at the party, so this is great news. I was going, I said something, pat myself on the back for that, instead of focus on those little things that we might do. But the monkey mind will focus on those little things and overestimate the threat.
Right. And then you describe in your book also, then once you see that the threat didn't happen, it reinforces the idea that you did the right thing.
All right. So I call that monkey logic. So basically, with all anxiety, regardless of what type, the behavior of choice will be avoidance. You're going to avoid going to the party, or you'll go to the party, but you're not going to initiate a conversation. So it's going to be avoidance.
Or you're going to avoid going on the airplane. You're going to drive the 12 hours
right.
to visit a relative because you're not going to fly.
Because, right. And so basically, the monkey mind is like, danger, danger, whatever that danger might be perceived as. And then when you go, oh, yeah, I'm in danger, and you avoid the party, you're basically feeding your monkey mind a banana. It's like you're actually reinforcing the threat perception. So that's going to make your anxiety worse. And then monkey logic, I call it, is that, oh, well, I didn't say something stupid at the party because I didn't say something at all. That's why I'm safe. That's why I haven't been kicked out of the tribe. So that avoidance reinforces the anxiety, and that's the part where, as a therapist, we begin to intervene in.
Great, and we'll talk talk, of course, about how you intervene and then, again, what all these different types of threats have in common. But it looks like we have a call. Let me see. It looks like it's maybe Magdalena. Am I saying that right?
Yes, it is. Hi.
Hi. You're on with us.
Thank you for the topic. I think it's such an incredibly important topic because it really can be a debilitating feeling to be having anxiety attacks. I have a question for the author, and that is, if you have found that there are any nutritional changes that can be made that can help anxiety, and I ask this because I have had a couple of friends who say that, you know, just by changing their diet, like cutting out gluten, I think, and dairy, it was, they have significant improvement in doing some of the supplement stuff. So I'm wondering about your take on that as well.
That's a great question. And, you know, it's so interesting because I was just reading a little while ago an article that I found on Facebook about probiotics and about the gut and how more and more research is showing the real relationship between our psychology and our gut when it comes to anxiety and depression. And so there's all kinds of theories about how to make sure that, you know, you are cutting back on those, especially sugars and processed foods, and eating enough probiotic foods like, you know, sauerkraut or yogurt to change that gut flora. So I'm interested in the answer as well. So, Jennifer.
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that. I could say I don't know enough about nutrition, and because I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist, it's very evidence-based, and I don't know how much evidence is out there as far as diet and anxiety. I will say that certainly having a healthy diet, having exercise, sleeping, all of those things can help with manage anxiety. So lifestyle certainly can have effect and decrease or increase stress. I would also say that most of the people that I see have often tried pretty much everything that they can possibly think of trying, and they're still having significant anxiety, and that's where.
Well, if anyone knows of a really good guest who would like to come on to talk about that gut psychology balance, I'd be interested in doing a show on that. And I do want to stress, and Jennifer talks about this in her book too, that too much coffee, you know, we know that sometimes coffee can exacerbate.
Well, and yes, coffee can exacerbate. I mean, it's a stimulant,
right?
So it can create that, you know, sympathetic nervous system kind of like response to things. At the same time, I will tell you that the type of therapy that I do is really about how to tolerate that discomfort as opposed to try to control the discomfort. So actually, with some of the clients I work with, specifically panic-prone clients, we may at some point actually have them ingest caffeine so that they can get used to that sensation and realize it's not threatening, it's okay.
That's really interesting. So sorry we didn't quite answer your question, but I am interested in it. So send me any resources. You could always send it to rona@nurserona.com, okay? Thank you.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. So we're talking about anxiety, and there are so many different types of anxieties, and but there's this overarching understanding about the way our mind sets in motion the increased anxiety once we have anxiety. But how does someone suddenly become, say, phobic about, say, spiders versus flying on an airplane? Like, how does that happen?
Right. I mean, honestly, it's a bit of a mystery. There's not a clear idea of how that happens. A lot of, if you have a relative, a first degree relative, like a parent or a sibling who has problems with anxiety, you're 3 to 4 times more likely to have anxiety yourself. So there's going to be a huge genetic component. Now, let's say your parent has social anxiety. That doesn't mean you're going to have social anxiety. You may have generalized anxiety or panic. Now, in terms of how, so there's the genetic component. There's, you know, things can happen where there's an environmental trigger. It could be, for example, like with social anxiety, you might have gotten teased or something happened that felt traumatic and you started developing sort of more social anxiety after that. But you probably were already genetically predisposed. For things like bridges, most people who start having panic attacks, say, crossing a bridge, it pretty much happens out of the blue. They're driving one day. They've driven over bridges many, many times before, and they're driving, and all of a sudden their heart starts beating fast. So it's, you know, I'd have to say that probably primordial fears, once again, there's this, you know, bridges are high. So there's probably this sort of almost instinctual aspect that, again, if maybe you're more stressed out, that might be what causes that first panic attack, mm-hmm. driving over a bridge.
And do all people who have anxiety at some point have a panic attack?
No. Okay. No, not everybody. No, not panic attack.
But that's often what gets people in to go see a therapist, I would imagine, sometimes is because they have this physiological response.
Well, not necessarily. I would say that really, panic certainly is incredibly uncomfortable. And if you have panic disorder, you're starting to, like, be afraid of the panic sensations themselves. And it becomes like you're always worried about the next panic attack. Certainly that has people coming in the door. I would say, you know, oftentimes it's when, for example, with generalized worry, it's where they just notice that they're worrying all the time. There's an endless loop. They don't feel that they're enjoying life as much. They're having difficulty sleeping at night. Sometimes health issues, stomach, headaches, things like that. And then with kids, you know, it's basically when it's interfering with their functioning in some way, certainly if they're not going to school because they're so worried or they have separation anxiety or social anxiety or panic, all of those things, if they're not going to school, then parents are very concerned with that and then, you know, bring them into treatment.
Yes. And while we're on kids, I want to ask you a little bit about that. And again, if you're listening and have a child who you wonder if what they're experiencing when they have that tummy ache and they just can't go to school, mm-hmm. and you know they're not really sick, mm-hmm. but that's what's going on, like, how do we deal with that? And if you're listening, you can call in at 1-800-958-9008. So give us some advice.
Well, okay. I mean, so again, as I said, that the behavior of choice is always going to be avoidance. I would say maybe let's take separation anxiety in kids where the child is really concerned about being away from the parent and
yes.
they don't want to go to school or they don't want to go to a friend's house because...
Or they may not even want to go to, say, daddy instead of mommy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Or they might not want to go to the bathroom alone in the house. I mean,
right.
it can be all of those things where they're afraid of sort of being away from. And all those kids are going to be doing a lot of avoidance, but also checking, where are you going to be? Are you sure you're going to be there? And then now with cell phones, you know, oftentimes it's the child's calling the parent or texting the parent, where are you now? How many minutes from home are you? Those kind of things. So, of course, with a parent, when you see a child in distress, our first instinct often is to try to get the anxiety to go away. But when we do that as a parent, what we're actually colluding with is the child's avoidance of something, or you're giving them reassurance over and over and over again. It works in the short run, but it really doesn't work in the long run. And so with anxiety treatment, it's really about how to face the fear one step at a time and how parents can support their child to actually face the situation that they're afraid of and instead of avoid it. And so that's really that shift of what you're really going to be supporting your child if you help them to move towards things.
So like a concrete example might be a child who doesn't want the parent to leave once mm-hmm. they've dropped them off at school.
Right.
And so the parent might decide to be compassionate and mm-hmm. stay for a little bit and make sure the child's feeling comfortable. But at some point, they see that doesn't work so well.
That's right.
You know, if it works, fine.
Exactly.
You know,
same with reassurance. If you say one reassuring thing and that's the end of it,
that's fine.
But when 10 minutes later, you're saying the same thing over again.
Right. So then that's where you might have to work with the teacher, say, mm-hmm. to be able to leave, have the child experience the fact that you come back.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It's very helpful with separation anxiety if it's related to school is to be working with the teacher. You know, the hard thing with separation anxiety, too, it is best usually to leave the child quickly, you know, saying, I'll be back and, you know, you can handle this and then leaving. And the worst part, I think, with separation anxiety often is for the parent because they're leaving the child when the child's the most distressed. And that's the image that the poor parent is imagining the rest of the day. The child usually has within a period of time been able to acclimate and is doing fine, but the parents that's not the picture they left the school with. But it'd be you know, leaving the child and then doing other things. I mean, again, you know, like going over to friend's house. Some kids who have separation anxiety won't go to friend's house. So it's like, okay, let's pick a friend that you will be there for. Let's start with 10 minutes.
Right.
And then move it up to, you know, 20 minutes. But the whole idea is to keep moving towards the thing.
rather than away. Yes. And then, you know, I also think the importance is the whole attitude with anything that's going on with your kids is one of trying to manage your own frustration, your own feelings, so that you're not saying, come on now, I know you could do this, your friend does it, why can't you do it? You know,
right.
That kind of yelling,
right.
critical attitude. Right?
That's right. So, yeah, you could say either extreme. So if you're, like, overly supportive and saying, okay, if it makes you anxious, then don't do it. That's not a good message. Or snap out of it. You know, just stop.
Man up.
This is irrational. Right. Yeah, it's irrational, but anxiety is real, and it is irrational. So how do you help the child?
Without shame, without blame.
Absolutely.
And
still having a firm hand of, okay, we're going to do this. I mean, with, you know, so... As a therapist, of course, I'm always helping parents understand that it's not cruel to, you know, have them do things. You and I were talking a little bit before the show about, you know, if you have a shy child who doesn't like to make phone calls, it can seem nice to make the phone call for them, but really it's allowing them to make the phone call. Now, let's say they choose not to call their friend to have them stay over, allowing that consequence. Okay, well then... You won't have the friend because you're not calling today.
That's right. And you have to know your child. And I think that's so important as you're listening, is like, at what point am I ready to really let them face this consequence?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no simple answer there, but that's a compassionate thing to do, is sometimes to let them actually face the
right.
consequence.
Absolutely. And, you know, oftentimes we don't know what we are capable of or our children are capable of.
Right.
And in my experience in treating kids and adults, they're capable of a lot more than you think. It's just being able to, if they can understand that kind of monkey mind, the anxiety, and how it's basically, how can they boss back that monkey? Because we are not our anxiety. We are not our monkey minds. You know, we have a life that we want to live, things that we want to do. Children do, we do. And we don't want to be hindered by that. So if you can get the kids on board of like, okay, let's defeat this anxiety, this monkey. How can you boss back your monkey mind and live the life that you want?
I like that. Boss back my monkey mind. Let's take more calls. 1-800-958-9008. We have Dave from Oakland with us. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my question.
Yeah.
I think it's a question anyway. My 9-year-old son has for, I guess as long as I can remember, at least the last 2 years, he just has a fear of, things that, like balloon pops, loud, you know, of being startled, you know, which I get, right? I don't like being startled either, but you know, anxiety or whatever it is to the, you know, it basically hinders him from doing things like going to birthday parties. You know, he'll, for as long as I can remember, he asks, you know, are there going to be balloons at the birthday party, instead of, you know, like, I don't know, another question that I have to ask.
This is a great question. And, you know, just from the temperament perspective, I want to say that some children are highly sensitive, and children who are sensitive to noise or texture or touch, you know, these things matter to them, and they will hear that pop 10 times louder, in a sense, than anyone else. So the question I always ask, and we can get the answer here from Jennifer as well, is when does sort of this normal wide range of temperament traits and styles, when does that start looking more like a disorder? So what do you think about the balloons?
Okay, so I absolutely agree. I'm so glad in terms of the sensory kind of issue, where some kids are more sensitive to sounds, absolutely. At the same time, that's something, because he's avoiding having fun going to birthday parties, so it's interfering with, you know, him living more fully. So what I would do is actually have him come into contact with balloons. But he can pick the balloons up, blowing the balloons, touching the balloons, throwing the balloons, and then eventually actually getting to where he could pop the balloon. So he's in charge of it, and he's popping the balloon. And you're going to be really reinforcing, like, okay, let's see if we can make this one louder. Can we make this one pop louder? But starting, we always work, I call them ladders, of where you're going to start on a lower rung and then move up. But it's being able to face and master that, so that the child can feel empowered.
Dave, does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I kind of initially when I noticed it, I thought, oh, you know, I thought it may just be like a sensitivity to sound. But at the same time, he's always loved the drums. And so from, you know, maybe he was 4 or 5, he's had a drum set and he played the drums and the snare drums, you know, it doesn't bother him. And he's right. And so there, you know, things like that. And I noticed, like, there was a time, you know, recently that, my wife took him to like a pirate festival or something, and there was the sound of the cracking whip, totally just freaked him out.
Right. And you know, immediately what comes to my mind is if I'm playing the drum, I have control over it. Mm-hmm. If a balloon goes off at a party or a whip goes off somewhere, I'm startled. I have no control over that. So I think this is a great suggestion from Jennifer to try is to again, slowly take a balloon, play with it, and then see if he was able to control breaking it. It might change.
Yeah. It's reminding me of a child I saw once, and this is a specific phobia, and his was a phobia of thunder and lightning, which is scary. It can be loud and kind of shocking. And now that you can't, you know, thunder and lightning, it happens at any time, but what we did with him was first educating, of course, monkey mind. How can we boss this back? How can we actually move towards it? And YouTube is so great now because you can kind of YouTube anything. In fact, you have to be careful about what you're YouTubing.
That's right.
But you can, you know, thunder and lightning storms, you can actually look at that. And sometimes what I'll have people, kids or adults, if they're moving up the ladder is, first let's close your eyes and even plug your ears, but still hear it on some level. Then maybe you open your eyes, but you're still plugging your ears. And then you're, you know, taking, you know, you're listening to it. Then maybe you're turning the volume up. So again, it's facing fears one step at a time.
I like the latter approach, and I think, Dave, as a parent, you know, again, you just have to go in there gently and slowly, and you're exposing it, but in a way that's tolerable. So give it a try. I hope that works out for you.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. So back to monkey mind. Again, mm-hmm. Tell people what monkey mind is.
So the monkey mind is goes back to this. It's really, it's another word for the amygdala. I just think it's cuter and easier to kind of think about as a separate self, separate part of ourselves. So that it's the monkey mind is dedicated to our survival, keeping us alive and part of the tribe. And it's going to be, I think with people with anxiety, it's like they have these hyperactive monkeys that are just going, you know, danger, danger at false alarms. And again, making those two common mistakes, which is overestimate the threat, underestimate your ability to cope with it.
Good. I just got a text from my husband, Mick, who listens to all the shows, and he says, hey, on balloons, if you blow up a balloon not too full, the sound is not loud when it pops. Okay.
So that would be a great way to start. A semi-inflated balloon and pop that. Because it might be harder to pop, too, right?
Right. Or just let it start coming, the air coming out and
that's
making
true.
A sound.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. Also, under monkey mind mm-hmm. and monkey miscalculations, right. You talked about a couple of things, catastrophizing mm-hmm. and also discounting the positive. I thought those were interesting, and also perfectionism.
Yeah.
So would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'll talk about, so that's right. There's a lot of different kind of monkey miscalculations, although I've tried to, again, reduce things. So right now I'm thinking, you know, a huge, huge part of anxiety is related to perfectionism, for example. I would say probably the two top ones is not knowing, intolerance, uncertainty, which is the idea of what I don't know might kill me, so I have to know everything, which, of course, you can't. We never can be 100% certain. And perfectionism is I can't make mistakes. I have to be perfect, which, again, is an impossible standard to keep. So with anxiety in the treatment, it is really facing your fears, but it's also, instead of feeding your monkey, which is, you're feeding the perception of threat, you want to feed your higher self that really is more of an expanded mindset, more flexible and resilient and can cope. So let's take social anxiety, for example, which I think is really an issue around, I call it social perfectionism, that a big thing of what makes socially anxious people so anxious is they think that they need to be smart and funny, not show any signs of anxiety, not have any awkward silences in a conversation. But, you know, we're not always again, funny and smart, and there's almost always points where there's awkward silences in conversation. So what I do with my clients in terms of facing this fear is not only facing the fear, but really feeding a healthier mindset. So I call it target practice. So if you think of a dartboard, and you think of that, you know, the
bullseye,
right? You know, that's such a small little area. If you think every time you have a conversation with somebody, you have to hit a bullseye, you're going to be really anxious, and you're probably going to be avoidant. So then I say it's target practice. When you're doing a conversation, we might start small talk practice in my office. I'm saying, okay, for 2 minutes, how could you hit the target? Well, you could hit the target by making eye contact, by smiling. You can ask me a question. You can share something you did during the week. That's target practice. And what you're really feeding is a much healthier mindset, which is, I don't need to be perfect. I just need to take risks. I need to be friendly. I need to put myself out there. And then when you do make a mistake, pat yourself on the back. Because if you just made a mistake in a social situation, you weren't avoiding. This is good news.
Yes. And so what you're doing in the therapy is just really encouraging someone to take those steps up the ladder. With the end result might be that, for instance, they could go to a social situation, any social situation, and feel relatively comfortable.
Yes, or
feel the anxiety and
there
go
we
anyway.
Go. So
and
that the, is yeah. much better because, yeah. again, anxious people have a very low tolerance. Well, we all do. Negative emotion, right? We don't like to feel shame, embarrassment, anxiety, guilt. We don't want to feel those, so we try to control the situation to not feel it. If you can kind of widen the bandwidth for those emotions, and I do a lot of welcoming practice with emotions, so with anxiety, I've relabeled negative emotion to necessary emotion. In other words, you need to get good at feeling bad. And if you can welcome it, you're changing your stance towards it, and it takes the sting out of it. So I do a lot of welcoming practice where it's like, okay, let's think of a situation that makes you anxious so we can kind of get your body to feel anxious. Once it's feeling anxious, then okay, now just open up your palms, breathe into the anxiety, and just feel it. Allow it to be there. Now, this is different than relaxation because most of the clients that I see have tried relaxation and it doesn't work.
Just relax.
That's right. Exactly.
Come on now. Just relax.
And in fact, relaxation can almost be an avoidant behavior. Not almost. It actually is an avoidant behavior. And when you try to relax, you can be feeding the monkey because particularly with physical sensations of anxiety, so rapid heartbeat or tightness in your chest or cramping in your stomach, all of those, if you perceive this as, oh no, this is terrible, my gosh, this is awful, I have to make it stop, I have to relax, you're basically agreeing with your monkey mind, which is, this is dangerous. And so what I'm teaching people is, okay, when you have those physical sensations, it's not dangerous. If you can just breathe into it, allow it to be there. Don't try to relax. In fact, you can even provoke it. Say, okay, wait, let me get a little more anxious. Heart, can I get my heart to beat just a little faster? When you're doing that, when you're changing your stance towards this, it softens things. You're going to basically metabolize the emotion much more quickly. And then when you're at a party or, you know, you're driving across a bridge or whatever might be an anxiety-provoking situation for you, if you've learned to say, oh, my rapid heart, oh, this is okay, I can feel this, it's okay, you're sending a message to your monkey mind like, hey, you know what, I can handle this.
Now, what about someone who actually thinks they're having a panic attack or an anxiety attack, but in fact they're having atrial fibrillation? You know, here I am, Miss Nurse here.
Yes.
you know, and I think that's what gets people sometimes into an emergency room is at a certain age or a certain place in their life, they want to make sure that what they're experiencing is actually not, there isn't any danger.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, well, I'll tell you, you can get a lot of teens who go to the emergency room too. I don't know, you might know the statistic in terms of ER visits and what percentage is because of panic attacks.
I don't know that.
It's pretty high though,
yeah.
That much I know. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you want to get physically checked out and make sure that everything's working. So I would say 95% of the people that I see with panic disorder, they don't have any physical problem.
Right, and once they realize they've been checked out, for some people who wind up going because they're afraid, then you get to work with them and say, okay,
right.
Now let's see how we're going to manage this the next time it comes.
Well, we don't even wait for the next time. So the therapy is really, it's about how to get yourself anxious but take a different stance towards it. So with panic, panic is pretty easy to treat. You basically get the sensation going in the office that they're afraid of, and then working with that so that they're actually, again, changing their stance, welcoming it instead of fighting it. I'll tell you, even after they've been to the ER and they've gotten EK, you know, all checked out, everything's physically fine, when you're in a panic attack, all rational goes out the window.
So you no longer have your higher
You're thinking, well,
brain.
maybe yesterday my heart was fine, but today this has got to be a heart attack. Okay. And panic attacks, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had one. They're incredibly intense. More than 20% of the population has had at least one panic attack, which doesn't mean you've had panic disorder, but you've had one. It's so intense, and it's very alarming. I mean, it is the body's fight-flight mechanism, and usually that happens when we're in imminent danger.
Yes.
So when our body's responding that way, it's hard for our mind to think, I'm not in imminent danger.
Well, I've had that. You know, personally, I can't drink coffee. Mm-hmm. I get a fast heartbeat, and I get that kind of feeling when I have caffeine. So I kind of know that feeling.
Right.
And I know that what I want to do is stop it because I don't like how
it's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. That's right. So we're talking about different types of anxiety. And if you have a question, call us. Maybe there's someone in your family or a friend who has dealt with anxiety but hasn't really understood how to get help. People often feel ashamed. Again, with all mental issues, mental illness, mental health, emotional problems, there's so much stigma and shame that still exists. And one of the reasons I'm doing these shows on these issues is because there is nothing to be ashamed of. And the more we can reach out and get support, you know, the better it is for everyone. And if you're a parent and you have anxiety disorder yourself, the more you could get help, the better off your children will be. Because when a child is being raised by a parent who's highly anxious or depressed, we know that impacts the child as well. Not to make anyone feel guilty, because we do the best we can, but getting help is really essential. 1-800-958-9008. So perfectionism, you already mentioned, mm-hmm. and I think that we have a society that also pushes towards perfectionism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the work ethic, and, you know, people feel like they really, their job is on the line unless they do a perfect job. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to help in general regarding that, you know, mm-hmm. on a societal level. But I guess when people work with you, you really help them understand what's the worst that could happen.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, you know, I'm a high achiever.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm also a perfectionist. So I'm trying to sort through that and just be a high achiever without the perfectionism. So I work on it constantly myself. But, you know, so it's the mindset. It's the worst that will happen. Yes, partly that. But it's this idea that, you know, we all do things well and do things poorly. And if we think, well, and it could be the other side. If we do something well, does that make us more worthy as a human being? And we do something poor, we're now less worthy? That's a perfectionistic mindset.
Yeah, I have that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A lot of overachievers do.
Absolutely. So moving and say, okay, you know, part of the human condition is I will do some things well and I will do some things poorly. And that's part of being a fallible human. So, you know, learning to accept that more. And again, feeding it with our behavior. So like with perfectionism, I'll tell you probably one of the most common problems is procrastination.
And which everyone I know
yes, which
does.
which very frequently relates to perfectionism. And so it's changing behavior. So approaching a task, but again, it goes back to that bullseye and target, like make it a target practice, not a bullseye. So if you're, you know, to make a task less overwhelming, you can say, okay, I'm going to, the first book, I go back to that.
Yeah.
Because when I was writing, you know, I had a passion for writing and getting the message out, but then I started getting anxious, like, oh my gosh, what if I can't write this well? And I started avoiding, I, you know, have found many other things to do other than sit down and write.
I found that with my book as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So then I was like, okay, hold on a second. I'm getting hijacked by my monkey mind here. It's telling me that I need to be perfect. I don't need to be perfect. So I started setting the timer for 30 minutes and just free writing. Just write whatever came to my mind and not keep trying to hit the bullseye. And I realized that confusion, not knowing what I'm going to say, is all part of the process.
Yes, yes. And I feel like that's where, again, some self-compassion and really trying to understand that my worth is not based on what I produce.
That's right.
And I think there's a basic idea there of self-worth.
Absolutely. And it can help to have values that you're working towards. Like for me, to be able to be helpful, to be able to be authentic, all of those things. If I thought, okay, writing was, I'm going to write and that's what I'm writing towards, as opposed to I'm going to write so that it's perfect, it's a bestseller. It's right. No, that's not a great goal.
It's not. Let's take more calls. We have Angela from San Jose. You're on with us. Hi, Angela.
Hi, good afternoon. My quick question is, the anxiety when you're in menopause and have never experienced an anxiety attack, but being in menopause, I'm now finding myself in such a state of mind that it is unbelievably unreal of nothing can be controlled. I'm finding that menopause is just slightly different than just my daily
I have to say, I had that same experience during menopause. I wound up going to the emergency room one time. I was sure I was having a heart attack, and they said it wasn't, and that it was probably just. And again, I thought that there was some change in my hormones that just triggered something. And the good news is menopause passes, but also maybe some of the work with CBT can help. The cognitive behavioral therapy might be able to help in terms of tolerating some of those times. And since your connection isn't so good, I'll have Jennifer speak to you off the line here. Okay.
You want to check out whatever physical organic cause that might be going on, and if that can be treated, then with whatever.
Sometimes they will use hormone replacement therapy. Sometimes there's herbs and other things that can help.
Yeah. So then it's like, okay, if there's something, can treat it physically, then you'd want to do that. But let's say you're still having panic, or you don't want to take hormone replacement, you're still having these panic attacks. I mean, panic attacks, again, themselves, it does not make for panic disorder. Panic disorder happens when you start really worrying you're going to have another panic attack. And that's where cognitive behavioral therapy can be very, very effective, where it's, again, bringing on the sensations, slowly in the office and learning to have a different stance and reinterpreting them. As realizing, okay, that when the sympathetic nervous system fires like that, wow, your heart's beating fast because it's a strong muscle and it's quite amazing at its job,
So if she's lying there in bed and it starts coming on, do you have any little tricks?
Yeah, I would say, okay, again, it's harder when it just comes on out of the blue. It's much better to start your practice with trying to bring it on. And actually, bringing on panic sensations is not very hard. Oftentimes, what I'll do starting with a client who has panic is we might do a hyperventilating practice where you're breathing in and out very quickly, but just sitting there. That creates a lot of physical sensation.
And that you want to do with someone who knows what they're doing.
Well, yes, you do, although a lot of self-help books on panic, and they give you a pretty, and I do actually in the survival guide, I give a very kind of breakdown of like how you would do this. As long as you don't have a medical condition, it's a safe practice to do. But then, then you're learning to just, okay, when this happens, I'm going to just feel it, I'm going to breathe into it, I'm going to allow it. And then eventually when you get good at that, I actually have people rate their sensations, their anxiety, and how are they doing welcoming on a 0 to 10 scale. So they're going to start off with a welcoming score of 0, probably, and then it gets up to 8, 9. And now once they're able to do that, they're going to be much better at those out-of-the-blue sensations so that they can use the same skill they were practicing of, oh, here it is. I welcome it, let it come in, let me breathe into it, and then the panic itself will last a much briefer period of time.
Right, and so that welcoming it, you're not getting more panicked about it being there. Breathing in just helps your breath deal with whatever you're feeling. Breathing mm-hmm. always helps.
Conscious breathing always helps.
And then I guess in some way you're telling yourself, I'm okay.
That's right. So basically you're not letting the monkey hijack the situation. You're saying, okay, look, I'm having this, but I'm going to have a different stance. I'm not going to just fight it.
And the book that she's talking about is The Anxiety Survival Guide for Teens. And I have to say, it's not just for teens, because I found it very helpful. Let's take another call. We have Greg on the road. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I'm calling because I get panic attacks because I've looked online. It's shy bladder syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been tormenting me for years. And I do the breathing, and it came on suddenly, and And I've had it for a long time, and I didn't understand why all of a sudden it came, and it's still there.
Mm.
Great question, Greg.
Let me ask you a question. So you said the shy bladder. So are you having panic attacks, like specifically related to trying to go to the bathroom in a public kind of area? Is it panic attacks that could be happening out of the blue, not related to that?
No, it's a public area.
Yeah.
It's sometimes at home.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's strictly mental because at times, say I've had a few drinks and I can go anywhere at any time.
Right, exactly.
So it's not like it occurs all the time.
Yeah.
It's just when my brain is relaxed or I don't know what it is.
Exactly.
Say I go down to the tavern and after I've had a few drinks that I can go up to anybody and just go, I don't care who's in there.
Yeah, well, exactly.
That's a great question.
Yeah, yeah. So bashful bladder, there's a periuresis is another name for it. Now, it affects males much more commonly than females, and I think one of the reasons is because of how public restrooms for males are set up with urinals, and women can kind of go in the locked door. So it is more common in males. You know, it is absolutely, it starts with this idea. Most periesis or bashful bladder is a social anxiety. So it's this idea of like you might have an experience one time where you can't piss, and then you start thinking, oh my gosh, this is really weird. I'm standing here at the urinal and I'm not being able to go. What is the guy next to me thinking, you know? And then it starts to give you just like panic. It's like, oh my gosh, what if I can't go to the bathroom this time? And there you are hyper focused on it when you go up to the urinal. You know, it's mental. It starts mental, but then it takes on physical where the sphincters for the be able to release the urine starts to tighten, and you can't relax it by the will of your mind. So there is treatment for that. There's actually a great book, and I'm afraid I can't remember the name of it, but I can put it on. I can put it like maybe on run on
or your just,
radio.
Yeah, if you leave a phone number, Greg, I can try and get it for you.
Yeah,
the name of the book.
So it's a very good book, and it really step by step of how to approach it and work with the social anxiety, so you're going to have some of those same kind of perfectionistic monkey mindsets like, oh my gosh, what this person's going to think. And the exposure for that is, again, a ladder where you start using public restrooms and you stand at the urinal and you purposely do not pee. And you just stand there for, you know, maybe up to 15 minutes. And you just go, okay, I'm just going to let this happen. I'm not going to try to pee. I'm just going to stand here and let people judge me. And, again, you're working up to this. But that ultimately is the treatment. And then when you start feeling like, you know, it's okay. So sometimes I can pee. Sometimes I'm not. It's not a big deal. I can handle it either way. Well, then, lo and behold, the problem starts to resolve itself.
Good. So this, I really appreciate the question. And of course, with anything like that, you always want to just go and get your analysis.
That's
just
true.
To make sure there's no infection
physical.
Or something like that. But once you know that, it's something that you can work with. And can you spell the...
Because I'm terrible at spelling.
Okay.
It starts with the P.
I know it's in your book.
It starts with the P. I just go with the letter.
Right. I know it's in your book somewhere.
Yeah, actually, you know what?
It is.
And the shyness and work.
Right.
The shyness work.
Right.
With, it's actually, I'm so glad that you did call in, because I'll tell you something. A lot of people with bashful bladder are feeling very embarrassed and they think they're alone. And so, you know, that you called in was just, you just educated the public of like, hey, you know, this is a very common, periuresis, P-A-R-U-R-E-S-I-S. And actually, the book should be here, too.
We're looking in her book.
I was looking at my first book, which I thought I had the... that resource in here.
But I think that's a good one to be able to do a Google search.
Oh, here it is.
Yeah.
Okay, Shy Bladder Syndrome, Your Step-by-Step Guide to Overcoming Periuresis by a bunch of different people.
Okay.
But that's right. And there's actually shybladder.org. There's actually an international organization for it.
Great. Thanks for your call, Greg. Have a good ride home.
Thank you.
We have a call now from Christine in Sunnyvale. You're on About Health.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're so welcome.
I have an 11-year-old daughter who has been refusing to sleep in her bedroom for about a year now. She has this nighttime anxiety of being kidnapped, those fears, irrational fears, of course. So we've been talking to her about this, but nothing seems to be doing her well. So for the past 12 days, or more or less, she's been sleeping in her bedroom on a mattress on the floor, and we are transitioning her to the hallway, actually, which as long as she doesn't sleep in her bedroom. She has two brothers, an older and a smaller one, and her bedroom is exactly located between the two, so we thought she was nice and cozy. But she has this fear of something that will happen to her, and it's been very vivid, and it's been going on for almost 2 weeks now, so we don't know what to do.
And let me just ask you, is there anything you can identify a few weeks ago that happened that might have frightened her?
Absolutely. Usually it's a nightmare. This time was a nightmare. Previous times, because it's been going on and off for about a year, could be something that she saw in a movie that scared her, for instance.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Or a conversation that she overheard, and she's sensitive. She's emotional.
Yeah.
So that can, her feelings can overtake her sometimes.
Yes.
And but other than that, during the day, she's completely independent. She can stay in the house alone.
Good.
She's not scared.
It's
only at night or when the night falls. Yeah.
And, think about the world we live in. Children who are sensitive have so much input, and sometimes they don't have a good filter for the kinds of things they see, whether it's on television or they hear about. And I just want to mention, before I ask Jennifer, one of the kids I once worked with, a family, it was somewhere around age 8 or 9, when sometimes children become more aware of things like death and other issues.
True.
This child needed to sleep on the floor on a mattress in the parents' room for a few weeks, and then it was over. So sometimes I just want to say you can see things that happen at a certain age or development, and then it resolves. And other times, because it's been going on for a year now, it might be something that needs more attention. What do you think, Jennifer?
Yeah, nighttime fears are very, very common. And I think, again, it goes back to that kind of monkey mind, that instinctual kind of primitive part of us, because at night we are more vulnerable. We can't see as well. And so those fears go up. Plus we're tired. So, we're tired. We don't feel like we can deal with it as well. So, you said that she's, I think you said, did you say like kidnapping? Or
yes, kidnapping.
Yeah. So, I mean.
Yes, or being killed as well. Yes.
Or what was that?
Being killed.
Right, like somebody kind of breaking in and killing her.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, what I often do is, I do cartoon bubbles with kids, so I have the worry thought, and how afraid they are, and then I have a smart thought. So try to get them to think, okay, so here's the fear, and you can even say, well, what's the evidence that this would happen? So that you're really pulling in, okay, what is your fear thought? Do you have any evidence that makes you think this is true? And that can help, too, to understand maybe something you didn't know that they'd heard, that they're saying they heard something, and then that can be helpful to deal with. And then working with them to have, okay, well, what's their smart thought? What's more true than the worry thought? And that's just at the beginning, just to kind of a little bit of education. And then once if they say, okay, well, they can come up with a smart thought. And it's best if you have the child ask questions so that they can come up with their own smart thought. If you're providing the smart thought for them, it doesn't work anywhere near as well. In fact, it's not a good idea, generally speaking. Kids are amazing at being able to come up with. They can access their higher brains as well, and we just have to ask the right questions for that. And then once that happens, there's also, the bossing back. I talked about, bossing back the worry thought. I have a monkey puppet in my office, and I use it with my adults as well as my kids. It's basically how to talk back to your monkey. So, I'll do a role play. So once you get what their fear is, then the fear can be the monkey puppet, and it's like it keeps telling the fear, and the child's role is to boss it back.
So I'm saying the monkey puppet's saying, so I can't be alone. I'm going to be kidnapped.
That's right. And then as the child, I would say, Kidnappings are very rare. Just because I'm scared of it doesn't mean it's going to happen.
But I know it's going to happen again. I know it's going to happen.
You can say that as many times as you want. I don't believe it. You know, so you, and when you get the child to boss back their fear, kind of externalize the fear and boss it back, it can be very empowering. There is a behavioral piece as well, which it sounds like you're already doing. Get, you know, having her move slowly back into her room is definitely a good idea so that she can, again, sense that sense of mastery and not dependency.
Yeah, so some good instincts. And then at some point, when you feel like things are, say, getting worse or there are more signs of her struggling, that's when you want to get help.
Right.
The fact that she's doing so well all day long is a really good sign.
Definitely.
Sounds like you're very smart and a really good mama. So thanks for calling in, Christine.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You know, as we're winding up here, I think I'd like you to mention something about terrorism and sort of the fear and the anxiety that a lot of people have after the horrible bombings in Belgium and Paris and here in the United States. Tell us about how the fear of the unknown figures into anxiety.
So, you know, monkey mindsets, one is intolerance of uncertainty, and that terrorism really strikes into that, because basically terrorism is, it could happen at any time, any place, some place that you assume is safe, and now it's not. So it's, it creates terror in us. It's that sense of we can't predict, we can't control things. So that's where it gets its fuel in terms of fear. I wrote an article called Don't Let Terrorism Hijack Your Brain, and basically it was, I was reading, I live in Santa Rosa, and I was reading our local paper, and it was after the Southern California, San Bernardino, there was somebody who was considering not going to a Christmas concert because in Occidental, which is a tiny little town, because it's a crowd, and in a crowd you know, you're more susceptible to being to terrorism. So the idea there is that while terrorism is real, but if we start responding to it with our monkey mind, which is like instinctive and quick to try to protect ourselves, we're actually going to be, you know, feeding our own anxiety, and we're allowing terrorism to control our lives. And what we really need in the face of terrorism is to think carefully, flexibly, resiliently of how can we best deal with this, but not let our monkey minds take over and make them be the ones who are, you know, going to be setting policy for it or anything. We need to really give it, step back, think carefully, and again, not let our monkey minds react to something that is, you know, real, but it doesn't mean that, again, like overestimating the threat. Yes, there's that threat. We can't control everything.
Right, and we can't control things. And again, you know, people who are sometimes afraid to fly, I understand that. And those people often go in cars, and there are so many more car accidents than people who die in airplanes. And again, that's not to be afraid to go in cars, but there are so many things we can't control. And a lot of anxiety is around the fact that there are things that we want to control and that we can't.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And I liked what you said also. You said, feel the feelings instead of reacting to them.
Mm-hmm.
When we're able to make room for feeling anxious and use simple tools like breathing into the discomfort without trying to get rid of it, we eventually calm down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that message is a real important one for everyone. And you can find out more about Jennifer Shannon at her website. And it's srcbt.org. That's Santa Rosa Cognitive Behavioral Therapy.org.
That's right.
That's right. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been really fun.
It's wonderful to have you. And thank you to all the listeners and all of you who called. That's what makes the show really terrific. I'll be back on April 18th. I'll probably be talking about child abuse prevention then. In the meantime, you can reach me at my website at nurserona.com. That's NURSERONA.com, or on Facebook at Rona Renner, RN. Dr. Lenore will be here next Monday, and my gratitude to our board operator, Erica Bridgman. May we all live with peace and ease and with good health.
This is Dennis Bernstein, host of Flashpoints.
This is Miguel Gavilan Molina.
host and senior producer of Flashpoints.
Heard on KPFA every weekday from 5 to 6.
Flashpoints is a hard-hitting news magazine that monitors the centers of power and reports back to the people.
We bring community radio into the community and give voice to the voiceless, from occupied Palestine to the falsely accused on death row.
From the brown revolutions in the fields of misery to the front lines of the new labor and civil rights movement.
On Flashpoints, black and brown lives really do matter. So join us here on KPFA every weekday at 5 p.m. Thank you.
Pape is the best-selling author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He and Noam Chomsky recently wrote On Palestine, urging the international community to pressure Israel to end its abuses against the Palestinian people. John Pilger calls Ilan Pape Israel's bravest, most principled, most incisive historian. A longtime anti-Zionist, Pape is now a professor at the University of Exeter in the UK. Ilan Pape will speak in Berkeley on Monday, May 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at the First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way, about why Palestine is still the issue. For info, meccaforpeace.org, 510-548-0542. This benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance is co-sponsored by KPFA and is wheelchair accessible.